So I think we should start. There's a lot to cover. So these are the topics that both of us are going to cover. Radiative inefficient accretion flows. This stuff applies to nearby AGN, and the prime example of which is Sagittarius A star in our galactic center. And then the physics of this type of accretion flows, what happens to the magneto-rotational instability in such systems. And I'll motivate that this is really the regime of collisionless plasma physics, in the sense that the mean free path of the particles is comparable to the system size or even bigger. So this is sort of solar wind stuff. The mean free path of particles at 1 AU in the solar wind is roughly 1 AU. So it's macroscopically collisionless. So there are some plasma physics ideas which can sort of be carried over from the solar wind, where observations are really exquisite. Okay, so basically, I'm going to talk about sort of theoretical aspects. And then in the second part, Jason will talk about observations and about the imaging in some millimeter. And there'll be a few talks in the conference later. But I don't think there'll be anything on this, so we'll pay a little more attention to this here. Okay, so let's get started. So these radially inefficient accretion flows are hot and dilute. So so let me just write down the virial temperature. So virial temperature is just the, it's just GMMP over R. And if you just write it in good units, it's just, so this is about 10 to the 12 Kelvin Schwarzschild radius over R. Right? So if the plasma is at the virial temperature, it's really, really hot, especially the protons. So so this is one thing to keep in mind. Then the other so since Sagittarius A star is the prime candidate of these accretion flows of this type, let me just mention the numbers. So the bolometric luminosity for Sagittarius A star is about 10 to the 36 Earth per second, 36 to 37 in the quiescent state, and most of it comes in submillimeter. During the flare, an X-ray luminosity in the quiescent phase is 10 to the 33 Earth per second. The black hole mass, of course, we all know. From the exquisite mapping of orbits of mass, of O and B stars around the black hole, is 4 times 10 to the 6 solar masses. So basically, it's a very well-constrained system. Right, and X-ray observations in the center tell us that a lot of this accretion which powers this emission comes or is fed at the large scales by the collision of winds from massive stars. Okay, so there are a lot of massive stars, their winds collide and sort of creates the hot gas density at a parsec scale from which this black hole accretes to zeroth order in a Bondi-like way. So basically, we can estimate. So we can estimate an M dot Bondi. Of course, we have to be very, very careful. M dot Bondi is actually a very crude and actually a very misleading estimate of the accretion rate onto the supermassive black hole. But it's a useful thing to keep in mind. So by getting the conditions at before M dot Bondi.
I'm sorry, how do we know that there are collisions of massive stars?
Not collisions of massive stars, winds from the massive stars.
Sorry.
Okay.
We see them.
Yeah,
I misunderstood.
Right.
Sorry, how do you know that the X-rays are from that? Because the X-rays are unresolved, right?
No. At that scale, it is pretty resolved.
Parsec?
Yeah, parsec scale is resolved.
One parsec.
Is the boundary radius, right?
Is arc second.
So our boundary.
Okay.
So 2 gm. Well, you know, these are just crude order of magnitude type things. So this is 0.3 parsec.
I mean, I don't know if it's compelling to you, but there's also the most recent Chandra image. There's actually elongation of the X-rays in the orientation of this disk of young stars.
That's correct.
I see.
Okay. As though we're actually.
So they are spatially correlated. And so this is about 3 × 10⁵ Schwarzschild radii. So we really know the system at large scales. And you know the temp. So I think Jason is going to describe more how we get these numbers and profiles, gas density and temperature profiles. But you know, so the density at the boundary radius is about 100 particles per cc, and the temperature at the boundary radius is about 1 keV. Okay. So if we plug in that here, we get this. You know, CS is the CS infinity, and of course, M dot Bondi is you know 4 pi RB² CS times rho, which is 10⁻⁵. So the mass here for Sagittarius A star.
How is to get the conversion temperature to keV? What's the virial temperature in keV?
So this is actually the temperature at large, you know, at the boundary radius.
No, I know. That's, yeah, 10⁻⁷.
That's 10⁻⁷. keV is a couple times 10⁷.
Right. So 1 keV is 10⁷ Kelvin.
Perfect.
Okay.
I don't know if you're getting to that. But I mean, the volumetric luminosity here is, you know, 10⁻⁹ or 10⁻⁸ of
any. So that's correct. So
very, very.
So L ball.
Supermassive black hole is fainter than X-ray binaries, right?
Right. So we can actually calculate 0.1 M dot Bondi C square, and that is 10⁻¹ erg per second. So you know you can see that the bolometric luminosity is 5 orders of magnitude smaller than what it would be if we just you know take the fiducial numbers for radiative efficiency. And the fact that all the M dot makes it to the black hole. Okay. Right. So once we know the density and temperature, so you know there's a very good evidence that M dot supermassive black hole is like you know orders of magnitude smaller than M dot Bondi. And I think Jason is gonna talk about this.
So you're taking all my stuff.
You know, I'm just going to go to that now. So we can actually calculate different. So once we have the density and temperature, we can calculate some plasma parameters. So, you know, so we can calculate mean free path. So we can calculate mean free path over R. So electrons and ions have the same mean free path if their temperatures are the same. So. Let's see. So this is like 0.01 R over R Bondi. So -3/2. So at the Bondi radius, the mean free path is 0.01 times the local scale. But if you go closer in, like a factor of 10 inside, you become collisionless, macroscopically collisionless. And even closer in, it becomes really, really collisionless. Even more so than the solar wind. The other, you know, this we just obtain from, you know, mean free path is a function of density and temperature. You put in the formulae and, you know, assume some Bondi scaling for density and temperature inside this accretion flow. If the density profile is shallower, this is even more collisionless. So as M dot is really, really small, so if this is, suppose this is the schematic density profile. So this is r to the -3/2 for Bondi. The actual density profile is quite shallow and maybe something like this. So this plasma, so this is density versus R, this plasma is even more collisionless. So basically the plasma is collisionless. There's no doubt about that. The other parameter of interest is this T equilibration time over T dynamical. So T equilibration time is the time scale at which the electrons and ions exchange energy through Coulomb collisions. Okay? Let me just write Coulomb collisions. And this is 0.01. Okay, let me just put the final number. So it's about 10 at 3 times 10 to the 3 Schwarzschild radii. So basically, you know, at about thousands of Schwarzschild radii, the electrons and protons are basically decoupled. Their temperatures can be significantly different. So if this was the density profile, and this is about 10 to the 5 RG, the temperature profile schematically would look like. So till, say, this is a log-log plot. So this is, say, 10 to the 3. So ions are sort of more or less close to the virial scaling. You know, this can differ a little bit. But electrons can decouple from, you know, they can be significantly cooler than ions. Okay, and that's sort of supported also from submillimeter observations that Jason is going to talk about. So these are the plasma parameters. The other interesting thing to calculate is the ratio of Larmor radius and the local rate, you know, how magnetized the plasma is. And for assuming close to equipartition magnetic field, which seems like a good assumption almost everywhere, this is like 10 to the minus 10 or even less. So that means the plasma is globally collisionless, but it's extremely well magnetized. So, you know, a rough picture will be, if this is a, you know, blob from a macroscopic chunk from this flow, the, you know, this is actually highly exaggerated. So particles just zip along magnetic field lines, and, you know, in principle, they just not collide. But what, yes?
So you're saying that if you're below 10 to the 5 RG, you are collisionless. But at the same time, you can have balance, I mean, the same temperature in electrons and ions.
Right.
Coulomb collisions. So you're collisionless, but you still have the same temperature.
Right. So there are two things. One is the electron-ion energy timescale. So there are two collisional timescales that are important here. Right? So this mean free path is just the fact that if you have an electron, what's the time scale that its direction changes by 90 degrees? That's the, you know, due to a Coulomb collision. So this time scale and this time scales are different by a factor of 40. It's just, you know, there is an ordering of time scales in Coulomb collisions. So electron-electron collisions are the fastest. Then, you know, then a factor of 40 comes between ion-ion collision, then another factor of 40 in the energy exchange. So energy exchange is the longest time scale. So, you know, it comes from that. Okay. So, you know, stuff sort of flies like this. But if there are magnetic irregularities, which I'm going to argue are there, so, you know, you have basically macroscopically collision-less, but extremely magnetized plasma. Okay.
So what are you using for the magnetic field?
Right, so it's sort of equipartition magnetic field. So if you put in the numbers, it's about 10 to the 3 Gauss, or, you know, depending on what scaling for.
Equipartition with electrons or protons?
Protons. Okay. That's correct.
Smaller.
Yes.
Sorry, you mean 10 to the 3 Gauss?
10 to the 3 closer in, you know, right at the center, 10-ish is what. Yeah, so it really depends on this scaling, actually. If you use the shallower scaling, you get a lower value because, you know, n is smaller.
Martin, could you say a little more about that scaling? So I was wondering why you might expect that it would be shallower than Bondi.
Right. So this actually comes from observations. You know, if you look at Faraday rotation measurement observations, they tell us that the integral of nb dl is actually small. So, you know, you can calculate a Faraday signature from density profiles. and looks like models with steep density profiles are ruled out. Actually, let Jason talk about it. So this is sort of the macroscopic stuff. Right, so if all accretion flows were like this, we won't have the transport problem, right? Because the mean free path is big, diffusion coefficient is large, you know, molecular transport is good enough. But the picture is not that simple, because if you have a magnetized plasma, the concept of viscosity is not that simple. The diffusion perpendicular to the field lines is negligible. Diffusion along field lines is huge. And effectively, it doesn't really behave like a very viscous fluid. It actually is much closer to a collisional plasma. And the magnetic field is what's responsible for endowing such a plasma a very fluid-like behavior. Okay, so because, you know, it's, even in this regime, particles cannot move away from magnetic fields. They are tied to the field lines. And then magnetic fields, there are magnetic scattering centers which scatter and make it somewhat collision-less. So MHD models, in the end of all this, will turn out to provide a good macroscopic description of even this plasma.
Sorry, what's the origin of the magnetic field?
You know, whatever it is everywhere else. You know, it's not an important question, you know. at these redshifts in here, you know, it's really not a... I don't know if you would agree with that, you know. Not only is there density and temperature here, there's also magnetic field here to accrete.
My retired colleague, Russell Coulter, would not agree that it's an important question, but it's a fact that fields are there and the image
don't immediately localize. I guess what I was asking, sort of partly, I mean, you've assumed a pretty specific thing, that this is a beat. There's no measurements, obviously. So the only thing is,
there is rotation measurement.
Are you going to discuss the EHT measurements that talk about the Johnson et al?
I wasn't, but I don't think that says anything about strength.
No, but it suggests large-scale coherence.
Specifically, you know that the emission is synchrotron radiation. So you know the field is strong, close to equipartition near the black hole. On large scales in the galactic center, you know there's evidence for strong magnetic fields, dynamically important fields. I think there is an interesting question of the idea is that you have all these stellar winds that collide and feed the black hole. Those are unmagnetized, probably.
No. Who knows?
Probably. Right.
You know, just the fact that there is synchrotron emission.
Most stars, there is evidence.
There's magnetic fields. How
can you make this? I'm just a bit confused about these magnetic irregularities that are certainly present, but they are present on a length which is much smaller than
right.
The collision, the mean free path of electrons. So how can you have those?
Right. Actually, I'm going to talk about that. You know, if you forget about irregularities, the plasma just leaves. If there are no magnetic scatterings, you know, the particles will just leave. But I'll argue that there are small-scale micro instabilities like ion cyclotron and, you know, fire hose, which does this. Okay. Right. So the other important thing to remember here is that this ratio, the ratio of the cooling time to the viscous time, you know, is an important one. If this ratio is less than one, so, you know, if this ratio is less than one locally, gas can cool and form a thin disk. So you can have a structure like this. This is the black hole. You have a hot, you know, RIAF-like flow, and you can have a thin disk here, and there's a truncation radius. And, you know, at radii where the cooling time of the hot gas, of the hot flow, is short compared to the viscous time, it can just collapse and cool into a thin disk. And within that, you know, this ratio is still bigger than one. So gas can fall in before it can cool. So it maintains this hot inner puffed up flow and the outer thin disk. Let's see. Right, so it's this criterion can be expressed in terms of more useful quantities, observationally more relevant quantities. So T cool over T visc. So, you know, let me just write down. So T2 is just 3/2 nkt. The thermal energy content and, you know, the radiative loss, you know, standard expressions for optically thin plasmas. And T-Visc is, of course, R square over alpha CSH, which is nothing but omega inverse alpha inverse H over R to the minus 2. So for, you know, for these flows, H over R is like 1-ish, 0.3. So the viscous time is only a factor of 100, 10 to 100 longer than the dynamical time. So, you know, viscosity is high in these models just because the disk is thick. So if you...
Particularly is doing great.
Right.
Don't show me things like that. It's upsetting.
Right. So, you know, we can express the density in terms of m dot, and we can express this criterion in terms of m dot. So it becomes, so T cool over T visc. Is alpha square m dot Eddington over m dot.
So, but you have one temperature or two temperatures?
Here it's all based on one temp, you know, inherently assumes one temperature, this part of the calculation. But you can, you know, make it more sophisticated by, you know, including two temperatures. This is just to, you know, motivate the fact that, you know, you can have such a structure, thin and thick. Okay. Right. And it's proportional to T^3/2 and H over R cube. So since the stuff is hotter inside, you know, the virial temperature is higher inside, T cool is bigger than T visc. So, you know, gas, it's at inner radii, it's difficult for gas to cool because the cooling time is long. So this structure is very natural for these accretion flows. Okay. So let me now, how am I doing in time?
25 minutes.
It's okay, that's not bad. So, so now I'm going to talk about, a little bit on the collisionless MRI simulations. So there were, you know, there are some shearing box simulations of the MRI in the collisionless limit. You know, the other thing is you can do a linear stability analysis of the MRI in the kinetic regime. And, you know, you have to use some sort of a model. And the simplest model is to assume that all the kinetic effects, or most of the kinetic effects, are captured by temperature or pressure and isotropy. So, so if you have a magnetic field line like this, the pressure along the field lines and the pressure perpendicular to the field lines, or the moments of the distribution function along the field lines in the perpendicular direction, are different. So the pressure that we are all familiar with actually becomes a tensor, and it's so in your minus grad p term in the equation of motion, you get a minus del dot p, and it, you know, these b hat terms, you know, this stress looks very similar to the Maxwell stress, right? You know, Maxwell stress is bb. Right? So what this tells us, that in a collisionless plasma where the distribution function is anisotropic, you will have a stress due to pressure and isotropy. So viscosity is nothing but pressure and isotropy in the off-diagonal terms. So, you know, this shows up here. So in addition to, you know, alpha Reynolds, alpha Maxwell, we'll have alpha anisotropic. This is due to anisotropic pressure. And you can also think of it as due to the fact that the mean free path is the size of the box. You know, I was saying that, you know, particle trajectories have an effective mean free path of order the box size. And of course, all these are like, you know, turbulent viscosities. Okay. So if we have two pressures, we also need two dynamical equations for these pressures, and it's easy to motivate them. We know that in a collisionless plasma, there is something called the first adiabatic, the adiabatic invariant, which is V perp square over B. If we have a slowly varying magnetic field, the particle likes to maintain this term as a constant. So this can be thought of as P perp over rho B is a constant. And similarly, and there is another constant which is related to the bouncing of particles along field lines. So if you have magnetic meters, there is another invariant related with this periodic motion, and that can be written as parallel B squared. Right, so if we have a local shearing box simulation of such a dynamical system of equations, everything is the same. You know, these are standard shearing boxes. The only new thing is pressure is anisotropic. So you can easily see here, if you have an MRI, you know, MRI is there. You can do a linear stability analysis of these equations, and you get the MRI. In fact, there is something called the magnetoviscous instability, which actually comes from this pressure anisotropy. And in fact, it's easy to see here that if the perturbations in this term are big, you know, it's really B hat which is important, not the strength of B. So there is an avatar of collisionless MRI which can appear as something called magnetoviscous instability, which operates even if the magnetic field strength is very tiny. We know for the standard MRI, KVA should be of order omega, but in this avatar, magnetic field can be orders of magnitude weaker. So in fact, that can be thought of as a mechanism for amplifying B fields. You know, if you have really low magnetic fields, you have this pressure and anisotropy-driven MRI that can build up magnetic field strengths.
That's assuming that the pressure and anisotropy is independent of the field strength.
No. It's the perturbations in pressure. So if you perturb these equations, so you can see that this perturbation of B hat
right,
doesn't depend on the strength of magnetic field as long as the particles are magnetized.
Right.
Right.
No, but in that sense, the Tite-Lamar radii of the particles is related to the fact that you have a field.
Absolutely. You need a magnetized particles for this
to work.
The
point is you have 10 orders of magnitude
right
to play with.
Right. That's correct. Right. So such a system, even if you start with isotropic pressure initially, you can see as the magnetic field grows because of the linear instability, you naturally create pressure and isotropy. Okay, and at most places you have P perp greater than P parallel, and that sort of, you know, you are overall amplifying magnetic fields. So, you know, fluid elements where P perp is larger than P parallel are many more. So there is a, you know, so this gives rise to additional transport. So let's see. So let me just write down the angular momentum equation. So basically, you know, this is the anisotropic stress, Reynolds stress, Maxwell stress, the same thing, but you know, written explicitly out in the angular momentum equation. And you can measure it from the shearing box simulations. So what is the value of Reynolds stress, Maxwell stress, and the anisotropic stress, and the simulations. So you know, one important thing is that this P perp becomes greater than P parallel, but you cannot let them become arbitrarily large. You cannot let the pressure anisotropy be arbitrarily large. We know that if the pressure anisotropy is large, there are a lot of micro instabilities in the plasmas, like ion cyclotron and mirror and fire hose instabilities, which will kick in as soon as the macroscopic pressure anisotropy is large enough. And their effect is to essentially limit the pressure anisotropy to something like 1 over beta to the some power, or you know. So if you have a high beta plasma, pressure anisotropy is actually quite small. And that's why, you know, this Maxwell stress, and then, you know, this delta P, this is delta P over P. So delta P is like P over beta to the alpha. So that's why this and this are comparable. If there was no pitch angle scattering due to these instabilities, you can have this term can be much larger than the magnetic part. So, but in the end, the effect of these micro instabilities is to enforce an MHD-like behavior. So, I like to think of this as some sort of a saturated conduction. You know, if you have a mean free path which is bigger than the gradient scale of temperature, then you know the conduction happens at the sound crossing time. So it's sort of a similar idea, which it sort of in the end boils down to, I think.
So in the simulations, I mean, you're free to run simulations without. This is like subgrid.
That's correct. This is all put in by hand. Yeah.
Once you hit certain anisotropies, then you limit it.
That's correct.
According to what we understand observationally about.
That's correct. And also there are simulations. There are also local simulations in the space physics community, which do that. And now there are PIC simulations of, you know, like Matt Kunz is doing the shearing sheets. And he sees these instabilities grow, and they are, you know, in most cases they are able to pitch angle scatter and, you know, enforce a floor on these. So, you know, broadly speaking, these ideas are okay. But how do they, you know, how do they actually happen? You know, so it's not necessary that these instabilities will always scatter particles. You have to, you know, drive them hard enough that this happens, at least in the MRI regime, where there is a background driving all the time, the shear, this seems to happen. So just one. So now we can also ask, so that was, you know, that was essentially a single fluid model of MRI in the collisionless limit, but we know that there are electrons and protons, and they are not collisionally coupled close to the black hole. So one can also apply these ideas to two fluid models. Okay. So if I write the internal energy equation, if E is the internal energy density for a species S like electrons or protons, you can just write the internal energy equation as U is the bulk flow velocity, Q is the conduction, right? So this is just the standard internal energy equation, the first law of thermodynamics, change it. So dU plus pdV equals zero, except that you have, you know, a viscous heating because of pressure and isotropy. And this can be, you know, this is true for both electrons and ions. You know, in the collisionless regime, not only the ions will have pressure and isotropy, but electrons too. And as I've already said, delta P over P is some sort of S over beta to the alpha. And this term can be written as d omega d log r. So this is the background shear. Delta P S V R E I. This is the pressure in isotropy, and these are B hats, R phi components of B hats. So this is the heating due to the background shear, and then there is also a term like right. So this is due to. You can volume average it, and if you volume average it, this sort of comes out of the integral, and this is what you get. So there is work done directly on the box, so that's the standard shear work done by stresses going into heating, and then there is some, this is like a turbulent heating, you know, due to correlations of local delta P and this local shearing.
Sorry. What's a dumb question? This is dissipative. This is.
Yes, this is dissipative. Here. You know, if you take a sheared flow.
Yeah.
And you know, there is some viscosity. If delta P is set by collisions, then this is a dissipative term.
Okay.
Absolutely.
What's delta P S?
Yeah, so S stands for the species. You can have electron and ions. Delta P is the same delta P, pressure and isotropy. So delta P.
But there is no pressure and isotropy if you are in a pure fluid and there is still a dissipative
term. Actually, the viscosity that we all know is be thought of as, you know, delta P, you can think of it as pressure and isotropy. It's, you know, one and the same thing. But it's, you know, this picture is useful in the collisionless plasmas. So, right, so if we have a shearing box, so the picture is, you can calculate these heating terms. So the picture is, you know, macroscopically, because of this large scale shear, this term is about 50% of all the heating. For both electrons and ions, about half of the energy goes into this heating due to large scale shear, and half of it goes into amplifying magnetic fields and you know, producing random kinetic energy. So it goes into a cascade. Okay, and this term, this heating, is because of that, you know, turbulent cascade. This term, this heating, is because of just the large scale shear heating. So, you know.
Sure this is dumb, but
no, absolutely.
So unlike in standard MRI where you have a turbulent cascade,
right,
which is presumably going down the microscopic scales and putting all the
heat, correct.
You have
an additional direct heating, right? If you write these
directly from the shear,
yes,
because of the presence,
yes,
of the
absolutely,
pressure, right?
That's correct. Okay. So if you write the equivalent equations,
in other words,
there's
a macroscopic viscosity.
That's
basically
correct. Absolutely.
Okay.
You know, yes, yes. Good. You clarify. So if you write the same equations in MHD, this term is absent.
Yeah.
So everything goes into cascade,
yeah,
and dissipated at small scales. Here you have heating due to this large-scale shear working on the boxes.
Right.
So, right. So we can actually calculate this heating rate for electrons and ions. So you can calculate Q plus E, which is heating rate for electrons and heating rate for ions. And it's nothing but, you know, if we just say that, you know, these correlations do not do any funny business, and we just equate it to delta P E over delta P I, and this alpha, you know, it essentially boils down to what you actually choose for these closures. So this is like, so delta P is proportional to P to the 1/2, because, you know, alpha is about half. So this is T E over T I to the 1/2. With some prefactor, okay? Yes.
If you are in a steady state, which is the state you should be, if you have like full developed turbulence, in, you know.
That's correct.
Then the left hand side should be zero. So what you're saying is that the two terms should cancel. Because I mean, there
right.
No,
so
flux.
Well, he hasn't included
anything. I have not included. You know, this is not the. There will be J cross B. You know, there will be exchange terms between magnetic. You know, so internal energy is also heated by
the work of
J, yeah, eta J squared and so, you know, terms like that.
The key question is basically how much heating do is received by electrons and ions.
That's correct.
It's crucial in systems like this because we want to learn about them from observations, and all we see are the electrons. So if the electrons do not heat, especially if that changes with physical properties of the plasma, then that's crucial to know about, actually.
That's correct.
I understand, but I'm just trying to understand what this term, which seems to be new, is about. Because you told me that the delta PS was actually the viscosity.
Right.
So I'm trying to compare that to the fluid equation. I mean, if you
right.
have viscosity, this term should exist, right? But it's negligible, that's what you're saying.
That's correct. So this is like...
I mean, it's not negligible because you have a turbulent cascade, so it's actually not negligible.
Right, it's this in that case. It's this.
It's this guy, okay.
Right.
So this guy, the
this is a macroscopic
thing.
Yes, you know, exactly. You know, you can actually write it down. You know, you can write the full equations down, and you'll see this term.
Okay. Right. The bottom line is that the electrons don't.
That's correct. So basically, the bottom line is that electrons heating can be is non-negligible. So if TE or TI is like 100, 1/100, this still gives you a factor of, you know, 1/10. So 1/10 or so of the viscously or the gravitational energy which is released can in principle go to electrons, and that's actually a big deal. And actually, it's tied to this question of M dot supermassive black hole. So, one last thing here, maybe. Right. So you can write L radiated, you know, L bolometric equals eta M dot black hole. C square. So the original ADAF models say that M dot is equal to M dot Bondi, and eta is really, really tiny. Okay? And now we have some evidence, actually observational evidence, that M dot actually going onto the black hole is much smaller than M dot Bondi. So that means that eta cannot be as small as the original ADAF models, because, you know, M dot really is small. So this fits in, you know, people have done, you know, we have done detailed modeling of temperature profiles and radiative efficiency with this sort of a prescription for heating rate. And we get, you know, so we say that this is a factor of 10 to the minus 3. And actually, in the end, we have to explain a factor of, you know, this was 10 to the minus 2. There's a factor of 10 to the minus 5 that you had to explain. And, minus 2. In fact, it's the electrons. So this really comes from the electrons, because electrons are what are radiating. So instead of being eta being 10 to the minus 5, the radiative efficiency can be pretty high. And it's actually the fact that M dot is tiny. So it sort of nicely complements the global work on simulations, which show that, you know, if you have a large-scale torus feeding the black hole, there are outflows, like, you know, outflows and convection and conduction, whatever basically increases the entropy of the flow is able to reduce M dot by a huge factor. So it sort of nicely ties in with that. Okay. I think I should finish here, because otherwise Jason will not have much time. Anyway, so this is sort of the broad brush stuff on RIAPS, this, especially the microphysics, yeah.
So
yes,
before Jason goes, so after you've done all these scans, it's true though that the electron collisions are enough that they can be described as a thermal plasma, and the ion-ion collisions are enough that they can be thermalized.
See, it's...
Two temperatures is still no.
Yeah, two temperature is still, you know, yeah, absolutely. They have to be two temperature.
I think it's a mystery.
No, I know they have to depart, but they don't depart in and of themselves. It's still, they're sufficiently well thermalized in themselves that it's... It's correct to describe them as a thermal plasma.
It's actually not thermal, right? T parallel and T perp are different. So it's not a Maxwellian distribution. And an anisotropic distribution is not Maxwellian.
But even that is good enough.
Yeah. Those. So, you know, even if you look at the particle distribution in the solar wind, you know, there are tails and stuff.
Yeah.
But if you want to make a very crude approximation, this is pretty good. You know, T perp and T parallel.
Yeah, the claim in the solar wind is different. There's these modified distribution functions that have kind of a thermal pump that then has a long tail, kind of mix of a thermal core with a power law attaching onto it. And I think observationally, to me, and Cedric's are the best evidence, is that observationally thermal distributions work pretty well.
That's
not immediately clear why, given all of the collisions nature.
That's correct. But that works very well in, you know, solar wind, you know.
Except that you have to have a relativistic component somewhere to produce a synchrotron. So. can't be all thermal.
Well, that's good. It's actually, it's consistent with being thermal particles that are relativistic.
Right. Right, in the quiescent state.
Which is kind of weird.
Right, in the, but for the flares, you definitely need.
I wasn't going to talk about flares.
Okay, maybe.
Thanks, Pratik. That's great.
Maybe it's it. Is someone going to photograph or keep this in some form, or can you scan it or something?
You can scan your notes.
And scan your
notes. Would you be willing to do that? Would you be willing to do that, Pratik, and put these notes up on the
Yeah, website? It's fine.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. Let's. Okay. So I can safely erase.
Yeah.
It's beautiful. I don't want to erase it. Yeah. I think so. We'll hear a lot of the active work next week is on this. Where do the electrons get heated? So not only what Pratik was saying about kind of the global electrons receive heat, but where it makes a huge difference. And in the Galactic Center, we have this somewhat unique opportunity to actually directly resolve spatially the accretion flow near the black hole. And so then what you see is the emission from the electrons. And so where they receive heat then changes a lot of your interpretation about what images of the accretion flow should look like. And there's a lot of recent activity, not just on this global rate, but how it depends on the plasma beta. So this Pratik alluded to that this ratio of the temperatures or the heating rate is going to depend on beta in the sense that highly magnetized regions receive more, the electrons receive more heat in highly magnetized regions. And now there's.
That's because the beta is low. So 1 over beta to the half gives you a larger pressure and anisotropy in more magnetized regions.
That has just immediate implications if you put that into a model that. The highly magnetized regions are usually near the poles or the corona in an MHD simulation, and that means that area lights up, and so you get things that look much more like jets or outflows, which then like accretion disks lighting up, which was the common thing in the old models. But that will be covered in the conference a lot, I think. Okay, so let's see. Yeah, so what do we know about Sagittarius? So Pratik drew these nice profiles. So as he discussed this. Steph tells you what's going on basically at the Bondi radius, which is spatially resolved in the X-rays, and tells you that the density profile is of particular interest, and so that's in the X-rays. So then also there's this, so I guess first I should say, so what do we expect actually so the other thing is that we can actually spatially resolve this accretion flow at small scales, and this comes from the fact that if you just look at what's our Schwarzschild, is around 10 to the 12 centimeters for a 4 times 10 to the 6 solar mass black hole. And the distance to the galactic center is 8 kiloparsecs. And so the kind of angular size of the Schwarzschild radius turns out to be about 10 micro arc seconds.
Subscript for Schwarzschild should be S.
I was going to use S, but then he used. Oh yeah, that's true. All right. Well, I was going to use. Well, that's true. But I was going to use. I was just trying to copy his notation. All right. Hey, that's. I think we had other S's, but you're right. It should be CH, of course. All right. Anyway, so this scale is actually. So this is a tiny spatial scale, but you can ask. Say you can make a telescope as big as you want, and as we'll discuss, the peak of the emission actually comes out at millimeter wavelengths. So what telescope size, basically, do you need? So this is B, lambda over beta S, and it turns out that if you put in here 1 millimeter, the telescope size you need is about 10 to the 4 kilometers. Which is the size of the Earth.
Is that an existence proof of God or something?
So there you go. You can image the black hole. Right? All you need to do is make a telescope in the submillimeter. That's the size of the Earth. Actually, not me, but other very hardworking observers have worked for a long time since the discovery of Sagittar to actually make this happen. And it now happens. There's detections of the angular size on scales comparable to this. So measured. Source sizes, resolved source sizes that are sort of 40, 50, 60 microarc seconds, something like that. So, and that's actually, anyways, what you expect is not to see
emission at the Schwarzschild radius. Right. What you expect to see is emission at several times larger from light bending effects and things like that. And so that the expected size is actually right in line, I would say, with what you expect. OK, but just going back to the, going back. So this is very exciting, and we'll be talked about a lot more at the conference, and we can talk about it in a minute. But going back to, you can use this immediately to then learn about the conditions of the plasma close in also, just from knowing a size. So you can estimate, for instance, at, so this is at sort of R 10 to the 5 RS. And then you can also measure then from this the conditions at sort of the size of the black hole itself. So for instance, you can measure that a temperature of the electrons is greater than the brightness temperature. This is the minimum temperature that you could have. And this is just from setting the intensity distribution equal to a black body. Given that you know a size and you know a flux at the millimeter, you can then just measure that this is a few times 10 to the 10 Kelvin. OK, and we already said that an upper bound was sort of, I think it still works as an upper bound, even if it's, say, a jet or something. But the upper bound is then something like the virial temperature. So you know the electron temperature is somewhere in between a few times 10 to the 10 and something like 10 to the 12. It's probably lower. I think it has to be lower. OK, near the black hole. So you know, you immediately know, actually, the temperature. And then you can ask sort of, so if you just want to know then what radiation comes out of an accretion flow that has these types of properties, then you can get this immediately by just comparing that these electrons are relativistic. And you can just ask, what's the sort of ratio of, say, so first of all, the optical depths are small. It's definitely optically thin to electron scattering and to free-free. So it's either, optically thin Bremsstrahlung or synchrotron. And you can just compare that the ratio of those, so I won't write it down, but if this sketchy thing that I did yesterday is at all true, it was something like, so this was just an estimate of the total power emitted in Bremsstrahlung versus synchrotron as a function of the plasma beta and theta e, the relativistic electron temperature, so kt over mec squared. And the idea is basically if the plasma is relativistic, then it's all going to be synchrotron. It's not going to be Bremsstrahlung anymore, for as long as, right, there's some magnetic field here. So beta here would be 1 to 10 or something like that. And so everything comes out in synchrotron radiation. Okay. And then given that it's synchrotron radiation, you would then expect also that the emission from near the black hole, so you can also ask where it peaks, sorry, so you can calculate,
I guess it won't get here. Temperature
Yeah, that's right, the relativistic temperature, KTM over MC squared. OK, and then anyways, I guess the, what's he going to say? Yeah, and then I guess, so what you expect then is that this should be polarized emission, right? It's synchrotron radiation from, at all scales, at all frequencies that we see, except for this X-ray stuff from far away. Everything from close to the black hole comes out in synchrotron radiation. Okay, you can ask where that peaks. I won't write it down, but it comes out in the submillimeter. You expect that it should come out in the radio somewhere if you calculate the critical frequency from synchrotron emission. And this is the spectrum that has been seen from ZJ star for a long time. So let's just draw that. Yeah, so it turns out that, so if you just calculate the critical synchrotron frequency, the relativistic cyclotron frequency, then it's something like gigahertz. The spectrum actually peaks at something like the submillimeter, so at 100 or 200, few hundred gigahertz. And that difference is attributed often to synchrotron self-absorption. It's either that, or it's just that if the temperature is really higher, then it just gets you there anyways. Yeah. OK, so let's see. So the spectrum looks something like this. And then there's this X-ray, the X-ray emission that's sort of out here. Yeah. So the data are, and this is in the draw in a moment, this is all in the radio. And then you kind of now start to see stuff around the peak, and then it's just a bunch of upper limits out here, and flare and stuff out here that I won't talk about. So this is roughly. And this would be like nu L nu or something. Okay. Yeah, and so then what you can do is look then in these at all frequencies that for linear polarization that tells you something then about the density of the accretion flow. And the crucial observations, I think, is that this stuff in here is all very low polarization. So no polarization is detected in the low frequency in the radio. But up at the peak, suddenly you detect polarization. And this detection, historically, this detection of polarization at 1 millimeter is what immediately tells you that the ADAF model, as it was written with constant m dot, cannot be right. And the reason is that the Faraday rotation would then depolarize the accretion flow itself, and you wouldn't even be able to see linear polarization, just because the Faraday rotation rotates the plane of linear polarization, and the densities in the ADAF model were so high, close to the black hole, that even within the region that's producing the emission, the polarization would make many, many turns. It had very, very high optical depth of Faraday rotation, and so it'd be depolarized. Okay, you can do better than that because you do detect linear polarization, so you can actually measure the Faraday rotation measure, which is interpreted as having a spherical accretion flow or something like that, a thick accretion flow, and then your linear polarization is going out through this, and this thing has density profiles and field profiles. And so then from basically then Faraday rotate this emission. So you measure a rotation measure, and the argument is that you're measuring the rotation measure of the central point source here close to the black hole through the extended accretion flow. Okay, so you can write down I'll just write down the result, but from the RM then basically you get it's n and then b dot dl. So for some range of models of again values of plasma beta in the flow, you can relate these two to each other. You say that most of the rotation measure is produced where the electrons become non-relativistic, which is a model assumption, but Faraday rotation is suppressed in relativistic plasmas by gamma squared or theta e squared. So it's probably a good approximation. And basically then you can measure at wherever, whatever radius that is, where this theta e equals 1, you can then measure the density of the accretion flow. And so that puts a point. Yeah, so if we go back to this, then this would be here.
Sorry, under some assumption of the field strength again, is that right? Or?
Yeah, so as a function of beta.
Yeah,
so in Dan Maroney's modeling papers for this, you assume some range of betas, you have to assume something about how tangled the field is or how much it's aligned with the line of sight. So you try to put some range of parameters in and then back out ultimately an accretion rate or equivalently a density at the inner accretion flow. But I think this is the point here, that this is really the n that you get from the RM is much below r to the minus 3 halves connecting to the Bondi radius. It's
so
orders of magnitude below that.
Years ago, these papers by Grusinov and Quatert or something, saying that r to the minus 3 halves you get in either free fall or adiabatic atmosphere. But if you have a constant energy flux, since this plasma can't radiate, you're supposed to get -1/2 or something.
That's right. So there were around the same time that.
Consistent with that?
Yeah. So I'd say okay. So this turns out to be something like r to the minus one is something like what one gets. So around the same time that this was in response to this detection of linear polarization, there were multiple people basically at the same time who realized, oh, that means you cannot have a constant m dot. So just to get back to this, so the RM implies that m dot at the black hole is something instead, it has a wide range because of these uncertainties in the uncertainties in the field direction and the field strength lead to a wide range of possible models to produce the same rotation measure. But a reasonable range of parameters gets you something like this, which again, compared to m dot Bondi. Do I still have it? I don't know. There was 10 to the minus 5, so. This was the first way to get this, that basically almost all of the mass that was available in the accretion flow at the Bondi radius does not make it down to the black hole. And this is what Pratik was saying about how actually the radiative efficiency, again, depending on which value, I guess I should have written them the other way, but which value you pick, the radiative efficiency can actually be quite high. It can be a few percent or something from this.
A constant energy flux gives you m dot proportional to r.
That's right. So the range of, that's right. So you can immediately relate these density profiles. If you assume that V goes like R to the minus 1/2, VR goes like R to the minus 1/2, then from the definition of M dot, you relate this density profile to these values of M dot. And then there's kind of the full range of models goes from R to the minus 1/2, which is basically saying everything outflows as much as it possibly can, or circulates in these convective overturns, like in this model, that the convection-dominated accretion models. So R to the minus 1 is somewhere sort of in between here. So this would be, if you took this, you know, literally, then you would say that M dot goes like R to the 1/2. So you're losing a lot of the mass, but not the maximal amount that you could be losing, which is sort of M dot goes like R. There's observational evidence, actually, for, you know, for very important mass loss in the sense that it doesn't end up accreting. But it is true that still, after all these models, different models were proposed of, you know, there was the adios type model, or the large scale outflows, argued based on the ADAFs, that really everything should basically be unbound in this limit of low luminosity accretion, anywhere from that to these kind of large circulating motions. And observationally, there's no evidence for an outflow in the galactic center at all. And it's kind of a pitiful amount of mass. I mean, even if you lost all of this, this is really the comparable to the mass loss from single stars in the galactic center. So it's not noticeable it's not carrying a lot of energy into the surrounding medium or something. The surrounding medium has a lot more energy than this. But it is evidence that, the most of the mass that's available is actually lost before it reaches the event horizon.
Even the spherical, you know, whatever heats the plasma is good, you know, even if it is conduction, or, you know, even if you start with spherical models, and you put conduction, like, even that suppresses, even that makes the density profile shallower and suppresses and drop.
Yeah.
So, you know, yeah. Bondi is sort of like a singular limit that, you know, it's an adiabatic profile. If you put entropy in that, M dot is naturally suppressed, irrespective of how you do it.
Yes, I would say it's still open. They're actually, there haven't been that many. So on the simulation side, there are a lot of simulations of the gas very close to the black hole, where it's like this. But there haven't been that many large-scale calculations. There are more, again, now, some effort in this now. But
sorry, your point is that there doesn't need to be outflows here.
Yeah.
You could just do it just with the M dot Bondi is just a horrible overestimate.
Yes, if you have spherical, do Bondi calculation but put conduction, for example, even that suppresses M dot by a decent amount. So whatever raises the entropy of the central region is fine.
Right. The constant fraction of the gravitational potential energy associated with the inflow in dot is somehow shared with the material further out.
Right.
Then as R gets smaller and smaller, if M not were constant, more and more of this energy would be released, and the system further out couldn't accept it. So it could be a static atmosphere sort of boiling away.
That's right.
Slow, very slow amount of accretion.
That's right. Yeah, I think the convection dominated model is the extreme of this, right? There's no outflow, it's just large circulations, but it creates at a very, very low rate compared to what is at the boundary.
And we don't know, though, observationally, whether that's really the explanation. That sort of thing is the explanation.
No, I'd say that it's somewhere between.
It could be an adios or a CDAT for all we know.
I would say there's no, if anything, we've introduced more acronyms since then without ruling out any of the acronyms. And that's why then people just gave up and called it radio
waves. I did my thesis in stellar dynamics. When Jim Peoples first tried to estimate the distribution of stars in a relaxed cluster around the black hole, he predicted a slope for the stellar density of R to the minus 9/4, I think. And that was a constant inflow solution. So the rate at which stars were crossing the radius was independent of radius. But then McCall and Wolf did it more carefully, and they got R to the minus 7/4, which is a constant E dot solution. So N dot is asymptotically zero. It's a conduction problem, basically, but the atoms are stars scattering off each other. So that if you have a singular potential, you can.
Sorry, just a really dumb question about this then. So, but you're still saying that at the Fermi radius, you're feeding at 10 to the minus 5, say. Is that right?
I think the argument is you don't know. You see the gas there. You would say in Bondi, this is how much of the gas, you know, you can very well estimate in, say, simulations of individual stars and their winds, how much of the gas should sort of accrete through an inner boundary at some distance that's far from the black hole. And you get similar numbers to the Bondi estimate. But you're not including all this conduction or all these other effects.
So even in CDEF, the argument is not that sort of material is accumulating somehow. Or is it?
So yeah, you have N and T. You just simply take it at a much slower, you know, you accrete, everything has to be accreted at a slower rate, or otherwise it will build up somewhere.
It's not mass transfer from a binary at a constant rate, right? You have some atmosphere,
yeah,
and so you need to match your accretion solution.
That's kind of what I'm asking.
Atmosphere.
So the 10 to the minus 5 is not like the boundary condition for the inner flow.
No.
That's the problem. It would have been your estimate.
Well, aren't there two possibilities? I mean, either you have to see that, and the actual accretion rate, even in the boundary, this is very low. Or you do have that larger accretion rate, but then there's a jet or something that's carrying all the mass.
Well, that's kind of what I was wondering, whether there's. Okay.
But there's no way of this is not, it could be either, as far as the observations
are concerned. Yeah, I have no way of distinguishing this. I would say there's, well, yeah, I guess you can try, if you measure more points in a density profile from various ways you could try to do this, then you could at least try to figure out where the accretion rate changed. You know, if you find, maybe you find over some range of radii that it is r to the minus 3/2, then you would say that at that point, you had a real accretion, you know, an accretion flow with constant m dot, and something happened further out or something like that.
But I don't get it, because at the Bondi radius, you have an idea of the temperature, right? So how can the gas escape from, you know, being attracted to the central mass? Or are you dumping more energy, or, but then you would see it, right?
I think the argument here is that
it is resolved, right?
Yes, it's resolved, but it's. But the I think the argument here is that the Bondi estimate is one model of how much, you know, the gas will actually fall into the central object.
It's like taking the density and temperature, you know, let's say, based on the convections of the sun. And you estimate an m dot, one solar mass in 1,000 seconds or something. That would, because of the density. It's not the right answer. The boundary conditions at the origin
just don't have
And here you've got a black hole, so the question is, the stuff, can stuff just go in and carry all its energy with it?
So what's the flow time? It's called estimated flow time. I mean, you don't have to worry about time difference at all in terms of feeding.
You mean the inflow time?
Because when we're comparing the m dot, the inside versus the outside, the time.
So the inflow time is much shorter than the lifetime of an O star. That's probably the, I'm not sure. It's not much shorter than the orbital time of these stars. So this is where, but this is where actually, I mean, you know, you can do SPH or other simulations with stars giving off winds just to ask how much accumulates at the inner boundary. And the answer has always been that, you know, in just ideal hydrodynamics, then it ends up being similar to the Bondi rate. I think like Jorge Cuadra's simulations find few times 10 to the minus 6 at something like 1,000 or, I guess 10,000 Schwarzschild radii compared to Bondi, and which is quite.
That's the inflow boundary condition, right?
Exactly.
And the other question, I guess, is the angular momentum crack, or has the viscosity high enough? Does it have to be high enough that you don't have to worry about that?
So, that you don't have to worry about.
Well,
that the inflow time can be short, you mean?
Well, no, just you're going from large scales to very small scales with a saturation.
So there's a centrifugal barrier that prevents.
Yeah, again, in say the hydro simulations, that's exactly what you would find, right? If you don't put in a viscosity, then sure, everything will sort of hang up there. Yeah, but I think there's clear evidence here for magnetic fields. You know, you need strong fields at the level of beta of 10 or something. So, if there's ever an argument that the MRI should be doing something, I think it's probably, you know, probably is here too.
You said that the X-rays are well resolved. So you have spatially resolved temperature and density, because I presume it's Bremsstrahlung or something, the X-rays.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, it's Bremsstrahlung, sorry. Yeah.
So you do know what the radial density profiles are on the scale of the Bondi radius. and the temperature profile.
So the original, yeah, that's right. So the original was kind of from the X-rays themselves. You would do, you know, there's something like, you can do something like that.
Okay.
So that is extra evidence in recent years for this flatter profile. They would argue that from the Chandra data, they would argue that they can also measure a density profile and that it's flatter than R to the minus 3 halves. That's also in agreement with this R to the minus 1.
Okay.
Observationally, I would say this is well established. You cannot have a huge density at the black hole. You would depolarize everything. You wouldn't see a small source size. You would see a giant photosphere of synchrotron emission that's huge.
Even that is not distinguishing between outflow and an atmosphere, is it?
No. You can measure the density profile. You cannot, well, to my knowledge, nobody has been able to.
The X-ray is relatively constant, or, I mean, it's been measured over a number of years now. Is it stay about the same? Or?
Yeah, that's right. So this is where there's this flat level of X-rays, which is supposed to be sort of 10 to the 33 Hertz per second, which is coming from this large distance. And one, you know, there are many arguments for why that, you know, you resolve it and other things, but also it's completely flat in time. But there are also these so-called flares. So the black hole itself does produce highly time variable X-rays.
What's the level of that?
Yeah, so the best estimates, if you tried to decompose it, of what the, I don't want to draw this as a spectrum because it's then imposing a model, but there's some level here which is from the black hole itself that you can try to estimate in various ways, and it sits something of a mean level 10 or 10 to 100 times below this constant level from far away. And you could find this by, for instance, trying to measure what's the time variable part of this very flat light curve that you see. But then also sometimes this jumps up to 10 to the 35 Hertz per second. So let's see, 10 to the 32. Yeah, so the amplitudes here are actually remarkably high. I mean, this is not seen in, to my knowledge, this is not seen in other quiescent X-ray binaries or something. But so the amplitudes of these so-called flares that happen, you know, once a day or so for an hour in the X-rays can be, our best guess, my best guess, would be something like a factor of 1,000 or several hundred from the kind of mean level of the X-rays close to the black hole.
And these are unresolved, and you said they last about an hour, and rise times are resolved or not?
Yeah, rise times are, what, 5 or 10 minutes or something?
Wow.
And there's infrared counterparts to all the X-ray ones that have lower amplitudes. And I mean, if you thought it was poorly established, what's happening with the density profile? Ask about flares.
Just why do aluminum bond year didn't get to be like the original bonding theory? Because I think the March year 2003 also that if you modify the energy equation in case of bonding theory or in the regime of spherical accretion, it is suppressed by 10 to the minus 5 times, 6 times.
So 10 to the 5 or 6 times? So I think here you can do a little better than that because okay, you have a boundary condition at some point, but
it's original theory. It don't bother about that, but you just, instead of p goes to k to the power gamma, you just put some energy equation there, and you can check it will be heating and also some cooling. Mm-hmm. So you can separate that accretion rate.
I think here there's better evidence just from the, you see the stellar winds. If you know what the orbits are, you can ask just how much mass you naively expect to kind of pile up at some radius. And maybe it's true that still gives you a poor estimate of, you know, that would be then, in one of these simulations, that would be then an accretion rate through your inner boundary, which then you would expect to form an accretion flow. I mean, maybe it still doesn't have the necessary physics. But I would say probably most of those calculations are not done in this limb. I mean, certainly if you're including cooling, that's not
necessary. It's very cool. Yeah, but the angular momentum is just, you know, they're like conduction. Whatever heats, you know, if you can heat the surrounding gas, then you're raising the entropy and, you know, making it difficult for it to get
heated. Yeah, so I mean, I would just interpret this as observational evidence that one should not assume the Bondi accretion rate to be the accretion rate onto a central object. Right? That's proven here that does not work. So that's how I would interpret it. What the cause is for that is, yeah. I don't know. If you could get more points, maybe you could show that mass is lost on smaller scales where it's less likely to be coupled to the outer boundary or something. But I don't know if we can do that. Actually.
So variance between rotation measuring and then something, right? Whether NVDL, the integral, is coming from inner radii or outer radii. I don't know what this is.
So I think it has to come from fairly inner radii, like 10 to 100 Schwarzschild radii or something.
Then won't you expect it to change over time, like at least till from 1999 to now? I don't think it has changed the time.
I think this is debated. Charles is here next week, you should ask him about this, because I think he's interested in this now. There are changes.
Given all these microphysical uncertainties, when the day comes that we actually have an image of the plasma around the black hole and see the MS, what are we going to learn?
About which aspect? So I think that, the main science, so the Van Horizon telescope, the primary science goal is to get an image that shows a shadow of a black hole, right? An object that has no surface, and you know what size it should be. You know that the shadow should be related to this size. It should be, for a non-spinning black hole, it should be square root of 27 times this size in one direction.
Yes.
So you can compare that to the image and say, that thing must be the shadow of a black hole. So we know that, at the radius, at this radius, then we know that this object is consistent with being a black hole in the universe.
General relativity in black hole, what do we learn about, say, the physical conditions of the plasma, or the accretion process?
Yeah, so I'd say that's the main thing that I've been interested in recently, because this is synchrotron emission, it's becoming optically thin just at the wavelength that you need to go to get angular resolution, to get around the scattering in the galactic, to do all these things. And that's great for seeing this shadow of a black hole. It's less great for learning about accretion or MHD, because the images are dominated by relativistic effects.
But again, there's this Johnson et al. Paper, which I thought was providing us some interesting spatial structures in the synchrotron radiation on the scale of the event horizon, indicating quite coherent structures.
And in polarization,
indicating probably strongly magnetized structures.
Yeah, so my answer would be that the total intensity images, to me, from models, basically, so far the data aren't good enough to tell, but it seems like it would be hard to make direct statements about the physics of the accretion flow based on the models. I mean, you can measure brightness temperatures or other things, but I think we have a lot of other probes, basically. There's the VLBI observations have polarization. Synchrotron radiation, especially on small spatial scales, should be quite polarized. And yeah, there are already data showing, for instance, that as you go to smaller spatial scales, the polarization becomes more coherent. So that already argues that there are ordered fields in the accretion flow. But again, then you'd have to, so this statement about strength is what's difficult, right? Because you could either, if you want this to be a MAD or something very dynamically important fields, you could argue that the fields are coherent because they're very strong. And if you want it to be MRI, you can say the fields are coherent because they're toroidal and they get dragged around with the fluid, right? So I think that there's more ongoing work but I think probes like that, the variability and the polarization signatures are going to be very
useful. I think there's discreteness as well. I mean, or maybe you can't tell that. It's not just a continuous, maybe you can't tell that yet.
Sorry, what? I didn't understand.
Will we be able to measure the spin of the black hole or its inclination?
So I think inclination to the line of sight is already well constrained, and that's because the relativistic effect. So you have two main effects in the images, which is you have Doppler beaming from the orbital motion, which depends strongly on the inclination, and you have light bending, and that you see behind the black hole.
The inclination of the angular momentum of the accretion is the inclination of the spin of the black hole itself. Assumed to be aligned.
They are often assumed to be aligned. I think that's something else that we might hope to learn. Yeah. I actually think just the complexity of the image can tell you about that. If things are misaligned, there may well be strong shocks or other things that make the image much more complicated than you would get in a normal case.
But your statement then is about the inclination of the accretion flow, or the emission, I guess, is that?
Yeah, that's right. So if I try to draw one of these images, often looks like you have a torus of, here, I can try to draw it on P-sites, actually. I'm sorry, just stop me when you all want to leave. It's probably long past that time. So if you just take a torus of gas and then add in the, you have some
orbital motion, then the image often comes out with this thing where the side here, where it's approaching you, is very bright. And then here, so this is again assuming that you're looking at some inclination or maybe Magellan or something, then you see behind the black hole from light bending, and there are paths above and below, and so you see bright spots of emission kind of above and below. And actually, the model images often end up looking as almost exactly like one of those protoplanetary disk images. Is that what it was? Somebody showed one, and like the first day I was here, and I was like, oh yeah, that's a shadow of a black hole right now. It's obvious. So they often have this characteristic crescent kind of shape from this. This is Doppler beaming, and this is the light bending. And depending on how you orient in inclination, you know, obviously if you go to face on, you won't see the asymmetry. So that I think they're actually already from the data, just from the size, basically. If you believe the models, we know the inclination is something, you know, 60-ish degrees. It's not 0 degrees, I would say, from evidence of asymmetry in the images themselves. So the inclination is okay. If you ask me, are we going to measure the black hole spin, I would say no. If you ask other people in the collaboration, they would say, oh yes, of course, with great precision. To me, the problem is that it's not clear to me in these low luminosity, geometrically thick flows what the ISCO does for you. That's the normal way that you try to measure a spin. So until someone shows me there's another clear signature of spin that we can measure well, then I won't really believe. You know, if you take a suite of models and fit them to existing data, you'll get a spin out. And then I would ask you, why is that spin preferred? And you know, nobody that does this type of thing has been able to tell me why.
Does their models prefer spin? Do anything for you? Does that get rotated
either in space-time? It does.
Yeah.
It does, but I haven't. So for instance, if you take a thin disk with electron scattering where all the intrinsic polarization points one way, and then add in the GR, there's a very clear difference in the polarization map where the parallel transport clearly changes the direction of the. I haven't seen nice features like that in polarized calculations in the synchrotron, probably because the field direction changes and gives you some nice pattern of its own, so it's hard to pick out. But that's certainly something to look at. Another argument people would make is, okay, so you measure the size or the shape of the black hole shadow itself. That depends on the spin and the inclination. But that effect is extremely small. It's a 10% effect in the overall size of the shadow. And the reason it's so different than the ISCO is because you see in photons, you see both the photon that came this way relative to the spin direction and this way relative to the spin direction. So you basically see both the prograde and retrograde photon orbit in the same shadow, no matter what. And so then one of them gets smaller, one of them gets larger, and it just happens that the overall sort of diameter of the feature stays roughly the same.
So do the flares extend to the millimeter, or?
Oh, goodness, don't.
Would you be able to have a picture, you know, during flare and outside of flare?
I think that is a goal that, I mean, if you see. So far there was one observation that was at a time when the submillimeter flux was higher than it often is. But you know, it's a continuously variable source. So anyways, talking about flares in the submillimeter makes me uncomfortable because it's a red noise power law. But anyways, it's there was one with no clear structural change, but people would say that. I don't know. I mean, so far there haven't been simultaneous observations. These observations, imaging observations, are done once a year in March or April for a week, whenever the weather is good enough. And so far, there have been no simultaneous observations where you've also, oh yeah, we also saw flare, and we can look at the image, and we have enough data, and we can say something. So maybe that's something you could do in the future. Maybe that would finally answer this question of, is the submillimeter actually a flare or something?
Well, thank you, Jason. Thank you for taking this. That was really great.